Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. Today was very sunny in London and that was very nice after much rain, and I, like the old lady that I am, I did some planting and planted my seeds out finally, and I find it extremely helpful for my mental health, although when I do talk about it, I do think I don't want this to turn into Gardener's Question Time, because that's a great show and I don't want to cross over. What I'm saying is, I hope wherever you are that the things you're planting are growing and you are feeling okay about what is happening. As okay as we can be in these still very strange times. Thank you so much for listening to me ramble on. I really do appreciate it. This week I'm talking to actor and writer Angus Imrie. You may recognise Angus as Prince Edward from The Crown, or Jake from Fleabag, or you may be a super cool cat like me and recognise him as Josh Archer from The Archers on Radio 4. Angus is a fantastic, brilliant actor who has also very recently written a play which is coming out on the 4th of June from Creation Theatre. The play is called Homeward Bound. It's his debut play and it's a heartwarming and light-hearted drama. The plot examines a brother and sister's attempt to appropriately and respectfully scatter their father's ashes. So it's a really interesting concept. It's a play he's written for audio, but also the amazing illustrator Lucy Jollo has done pictures to go with it. And you can download the whole thing from the Creation Theatre website for just £5. That's www.creationtheatre.co.uk. And then the idea is to find ways of dealing with what's happening in a light-hearted, fun way, but in a way that's sort of away from screens, is what Creation Theatre have been working from. And it's a beautiful, really lovely, charming play and features himself and some other Archers actors as well. I'll give more details at the end. Angus came to talk to me about his dad, the actor Benjamin Whitrow, who passed away 4 years ago. So, Angus, who are we remembering today?
We're remembering my dad, Benjamin Whitrow, who died in 2017. So
Yes, not long ago.
It's a peculiar one. It feels recent, but also when I think about how long ago that is, it's significant amount of time. But it does still feel recent.
So is that 4 years ago, roughly?
Yeah. September it was.
September. Yeah, that's tricky. That's a tricky time because, as we say on the show, like one and two, people sort of still give you a bit of space. They're like, oh, yeah, that's just died.
Right.
Three and four, they're like, oh, still going on about it.
Okay. Still like, banging on about that.
All right. And then by five is quite hard because it feels like a sort of chunky number, five. And by five, right, often a lot of people are like, oh, wow, really? Still a thing. And So I think four is hard because it's like, it's not, like you said, it's recent and not recent at exactly the same time. Mm. And are you having this, I mean, I'm having this 20 plus years, that because we've just been through such a strange thing, and like, he, you know, he missed it in you know, inverted commas, but that's a terrible way of explaining it. But like, are you having that slight like, oh God, he went just before this thing happened to the world and they didn't know about it?
Yeah, that's a weird one. He was a great catastrophizer. Is that a word?
You know, it is,
like my dad. He constantly thought we were on the brink of, you know, destruction. I mean, I remember being in the car once with him. We were on our way to spend Christmas with some family. And he said to me, well, at least we can have this Christmas together. And I said, what do you mean? What do you mean, Dad? And he said, there won't be another like this. Why not? Stay to the world, he said to me, right? He really, really was a doomster like that. And so I think he always thought something like this was around the corner, And I think he would have been rather smug about, you know, the fact that he predicted it somehow.
I said, I did say.
yeah, he really would have. But, you know, there is a weird thing of being quite relieved in a way that he didn't have to go through it. You know, he lived on his own and I spent a lot of time with him, but you know, it's with the situation as it has been over this last year, you don't know what could have happened. So there's a mixed feeling about being glad or not glad.
It's weird, isn't it? It's just a, I guess it's just, you, everybody sort of checks in with like, wow, they didn't know that happened. And like, but I'm a catastrophizer, so I have like terrible anxiety.
Really?
Yeah, and I've got better. Thank you, therapy. And but like when it happened, I was definitely like, I mean, I kind of knew something bad was gonna happen. Like, that's the weird thing about anxiety, is like most days it's really annoying because nothing happens, but the day something does happen, you're like, yes.
you're so prepared
yeah. Like those first few weeks I was definitely like, when other people were kind of like, oh my, I was like, yeah, this is what we all knew was gonna happen. But then afterwards you're like, oh, I still feel awful. I'm still having to go through it despite thinking I was prepared. It didn't save me in any way. So what did your dad die of?
Well, he had a fall. He had a fall and, you know, bumped his head badly. And so there was complications with that. There was a bleed on the brain, and so it was very sudden, really.
Yeah.
But he'd been very ill that previous year. He was as well as being a catastrophizer, he was a big self-diagnoser of his illnesses.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he had some kind of cough or something and he got it in his head that he needed to cough it up, you know. And I'd be with him and he'd be, you know, hacking away in the loo. And I'd be like, Dad, you really don't need to cough like that. Anyway, it did cause like a problem with his lung, all this vigorous coughing. He got this terrible bruising and he had to go into hospital for quite a prolonged period of time earlier that year in February. And, you know, he did come out of hospital and he was okay again, but he was much, much more frail than he had been. So we were familiar with, you know, being in hospital with him and considering the future, I guess. And so, although when he did have that fall, it was a terrible shock, we'd had the experience of being in hospital with him earlier that year.
Yeah.
And he was more frail. But yeah, there's never a good way, is there? But
how old was he?
If you don't mind me. 80. He turned 80 in hospital earlier that year. And the nurses were unbelievable. I mean, you know, everybody says they are, but you just can't believe how extraordinary they are at the NHS. And they brought him a massive birthday cake, you know. And he was very frail when he... on his 80th, but he got to his feet and gave them all a round of applause. He was so happy. It was lovely.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah, that's hard, isn't it? That's because, you know, it doesn't matter what age someone is. Oh, we've said this before on the show.
Mm.
Once that door closes, that's a really different scenario. And I think we can all be, you know, I know friends who have had elderly parents or, you know, who'll be like, oh, no, I thought I was... oh, you know, my dad is, oh, I am aware of that, you know. But it's different when you finally get the news and you're like, oh, okay, now I have to deal with that fact, and not being like, again, this idea of preparedness, that you can be prepared for something. you sort of can, but you can't exactly at the same time.
Yeah, definitely not.
So did you just get a phone call to say...
Well, it was very peculiar, the circumstances around it. I mean, so when he was in hospital, I'd been at drama school and I'd visit him almost every day. I'd cycle straight to the hospital, spend time with him. But then he came out for a number of months and he was, you know, in good spirits. And he came to see some of my shows and we went to galleries together and we spent a lot of time together. And then, yeah, I was at home and my mum was away. And weirdly, I was reading a passage. Do you know the book A Little Life?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it. I know it's, yeah, one that makes you bore your eyes out. That's all I know.
It does, yeah. But there's an extraordinary section quite early on in the book, which is just talking about grief. And actually, the narrator, Howard, in that section says, you know, I'm not going to write anything about grief because it's all been said before. Mm. But there's a little description about how he thinks he sees his son all the time, you know, and he just walking along the road, oh, I saw him there, or I saw him another time. And they're different people and very different, living very different lives, but he's imagining what he could have been, you know. And I was reading that out on the phone to my girlfriend when I got the call from my mum. And she had been told by my brother just that he'd had a fall. Anyway, I went straight to the hospital. And what's peculiar is my dad had been quite lucid, you know. He was the one who made the call to the ambulance.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And had been shouting to the neighbours, you know. But by the time I got to the hospital, he was, you know, unconscious and had never regained consciousness. So, and I saw my brother in the hospital. And then I went to stay the night with him that night. And then the next morning, we sort of gathered in the hospital and we had the decision, I suppose, about taking the life support off type thing. So it was more drawn out than an immediate end. It was very strange that night at my brother's. I'll never forget. I slept on his sofa and we had a beer, you know, that night. It was quite late. And I just caught this sight of my brother suddenly looking so like my dad. It was as if he was there. It was such an extraordinary moment. You know, something about the light, he just looked exactly like my dad. But yeah, in a way, it was nice to be able to gather together and be there for the moment. I know, and I've listened a lot on your podcast about that moment of someone dying, whether the family want to be there, whether the person who's dying want the family to be there. Yeah. But I felt it was important to, although death is grisly, you know, you feel this sense of, I don't know, some people might not, but I wanted to. I wanted to somehow be there for him and also try and take on something of him as he died. You know, if I could continue something of his life, I don't know what it was. But you're searching for something beyond the corporeal, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're searching for something else. Yeah, so me and my brother were there the moment that we took off the life support.
God, that's a very, like you said, it's hard to describe, isn't it? Because it's a sort of precious moment, but precious sort of implies like a joyful moment, but it's like, it's not joyful, isn't right, is it? But it's precious to be able to be there for your dad in that way.
You just go through so many different stages, don't you? Because you say joyful, and I don't think that's a wrong, you know, precious, and I think that can be it, because even in, during that time, you have these depths of true, like, misery that you don't know whether you'll ever recover. You don't even know whether you'll be able to breathe because you're so grief-stricken. But somehow, on the flip side of that, you can take heart from, you know, being there, and you can take some joy, and then suddenly you're back down. It's this extraordinary mixture and extraordinary deep wells and then coming back up, isn't it?
I think it's hard because it's like that rational part of your brain is like, it's just expecting misery. So I think when that happens, we never question it. We're like, yeah, someone's dying, I feel awful. Yes, correct. Mm. When any other emotion appears, you're like, oh, what's that? What's this?
Yeah,
but that is grief and death. Or it's like you said, it's this mixture, it's this wave, it's all of these things wrapped up in one, but we sort of question the bits that feel precious or joyful, or you take heart in them, you're like, is that right? Am I supposed to be? But
yeah, any human experience is never one thing. It's never all bad or all good. It's just so mixed up. So I think that's nice that, you know, it's nice that you were able to be there for him and you wanted to be there. I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Like you said, some people don't want to, some people who are dying don't want to, but clearly that was what worked for all of you. Is your brother older?
Yeah, I mean, technically he's my half-brother, but, you know, we think of each other as brother and it's brought us very close. And yes, he's older than me.
Yeah.
About 18 years older.
So you were able to be there with him, which is, yeah, as you said, is something you felt really important. I think that's a really nice phrase you're using, gather. I think that's so weird, isn't it? It's like, what is that? Like, this human need to, like, gather everybody. And, like you said, it's not something that, it's not something that someone, this is what you should do when someone dies, you need to do this. It's like, you just know innately, like, gather the people that are important.
Absolutely.
Like, and we must all be around them. It's such a weird, like, instinct, really, isn't it? Rather than any rational decision.
Absolutely. I'm so happy that there was, you know, a gathering around him and we were there for each other at the hospital. But also, I wish, and I think, you know, if I go through something like this again, I think more people, you know, I think that, like, we have this peculiar, I think in the immediate aftermath, we were all together as a family, but then what? Then you think, oh, well, I just need to be with my family. I just need some time or something. That's, I found myself coming out with these cliches that I thought were appropriate somehow. Yeah. But actually, the more people I could have been surrounded by, I think the better. You know, I was talking to Carol, who's my brother's partner, and she's comes from Ireland, you know, and she was saying that when we were all back in the house afterwards, she was saying, oh, by now there'd be a wake, the whole house would be filled with people, tea would be sloshing, biscuits would, you know, people you've never met would be there. And maybe I'm being naive, but I think somehow being surrounded by people feels like a better, or it feels like a way to remember them better and find those rituals which I think connect us and help us deal with things. And I think that in the absence of those, it becomes a bit harder to deal with things by yourself. So yeah, I think I really think that gathering, even if it's people that you don't know, the more that people can be around and tell stories, because that was the thing that meant the most to me, was when I'd hear stories about my dad that I'd never heard before. Quite soon after he died, I went and stayed with a friend of mine in Edinburgh called Jack. And Jack's mum, Carey, we had a really lovely stay in Edinburgh together and we went hiking and things. And as I left, she was dropping me off at the station in the car. And she said, your relationship with him will grow and grow. And I went, okay, thanks for that. Whatever. He's dead. I don't think so. But I could not believe how right that was, you know, because when he died, the thing that devastated me so much was I couldn't bear every day that passed was a day further away from him.
Yeah,
you know, I just, that really, really got to me. And I was terrified of losing the memories of him and the stories. But she was right. Suddenly, when you're remembering him with other people, they're telling you things which add to your experiences with him somehow. They it does grow. And I just thought it was an amazingly insightful thing that she said.
Yeah, it's funny because I think when you know, you're right in the aftermath, you know, people say stuff, you're like, what the fuck? Like,
but then
it takes time, especially if someone is older, then you're like, oh, I see, they've lived through things. But when you're younger, like, what is the thing? What? But I think it's really hard when, because you're in relationship to that person, as you know, you were a son and a father and son, that was a relationship. Mm. And I think sometimes people don't realize that these stories are gold dust, because they start making, you know, you build this sort of circle of a person. So you've got this relationship, one, this little part of the pie chart of, like, which is dad. And then they're giving you, like, colleague or friend or brother or all this other stuff. And you're like, oh, I can just, it makes them more real suddenly, because they're not there to be real. Like, anything that's like, oh, I feel like, and anecdotes are so precious, aren't they? Because it's like you feel like you can sort of put your hand on a bit of them that you didn't know, kind of thing. It's like they suddenly are a bit more visual, a bit more there, or visceral. I don't know what it is. And yeah, it's so lovely hearing those stories. And like you said, I guess it's such a common thing that people do suddenly come together and suddenly share stories, and all these hilarious stories come out about someone, which I do always think, why not so much when they're alive? Why do we all have to gather now and share all these brilliant stories?
I know.
Why when we were alive? So we're not just weird, like, isn't it? Hey, we've got all these great stories. But sure, it's still great, it happens. So yeah, the idea of the relationship growing. And the other thing you said, which I really relate to, is that idea that there's this, like, you're on a linear timeline. And so when they die, it's like, that's the day, that's the marker that you're like being dragged away from. And every day you're like, get me back. So that's where they were. Yeah. That's when I knew them. That's when they knew me. Like, and that's a really hard thing to reconcile with, because that's time. Like, you can't fight time. And so it's like, really, that's a definitely a big sort of big human thing I had to sort of, find a peace with, of like, there's nothing I can do about that. There's literally nothing. Like, I think you can gather more anecdotes, you can find more things, you can remember, but just going away from them is just like, it's just part of grief and that process of sort of learning to deal with it. Do you still think about that now, 4 years on? Are you still kind of aware of like where he was and where you are?
The days passing since, I mean, I think so. It's so weird. The times I think about him, I dream about him all the time. I don't know whether you have that experience, but like, and that's a very peculiar thing, because, you know, it's your subconscious. Mm. And what's horrible is whenever you dream about them, they're always alive.
Yeah, of course.
Because you can't really, I mean, you know, so then you really do kid yourself. Every time I have a dream, there's been a big mistake. I'm so relieved, Dad. I, it's so weird. Everyone's thought you were dead, but you're here. I'm so happy. What is this bigger misunderstanding? Yeah. And there'll always be some sort of explanation. So it's always like you come crashing back down to earth, and then, you know, when you wake up. And that's the thing that makes me reflect. And like, and having his things as well. I really like having some of his things, and that's a constant reminder of.
Yeah,
it's the thing is, though, I miss him for my sake, not for his sake. You know, that's for me to deal with. I know that he wouldn't feel like he needed to carry on living and living and living, you know. So there is some peace in that, I think, I think in the immediate aftermath, when your grief is really, really powerful, you can't get beyond your feeling.
Mm.
But I think now that 4 years are on, although I'm still desperately sad, it doesn't mean that I've found that, because I know that he wouldn't want to have carried on. It's okay. It's just for me to deal with, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does totally. And I think that's I don't know. That's the right word, but I think it's healthy that you kind of reach a place where you're like, this is about me, I would like them here. Like, that's not how the world works. And yeah, that is this sort of weird, I mean, I say like come to a peace with it, which I think sometimes might sound unfair, but I mean, obviously I'm 20 plus years, so you sort of have to eventually come to a peace with it. But I do, yeah, I think you sort of, and that's what people mean when they say time heals is such a stupid phrase, it doesn't mean anything, but the truth behind it, like all good cliches, is that, like, you know, hindsight, and the further you get away, you do sort of get better at accepting things. I think that's it. Just take longer to accept things, and then you can say, like, I think what you're saying, this is about me. Like, I would like him here, but that's not that's not what happened, and that's okay. And that's okay. And actually, for him, that's okay.
Yeah.
Were you still at drama school when he died? Then
I just graduated. It was peculiar. He was working when he died. He was playing John Betjeman in a Radio 4 programme.
If you don't know, your dad was an incredible actor. Like, and
he was great.
Obviously, this is probably not his best work, as in, like, what's the word? Like, a cliched point of call, but, like, I do a show called Ostentatious. So I've watched a lot of Jane Austen adaptations. And, of course, your dad was... I suddenly doubt myself, but not my Mr. Bennett.
Yeah.
in the best Jane Austen adaptation has ever been. I will stand by that by law. But yeah, he was an amazing actor. So incredible. So he was still working even at that age.
Yeah, I mean, a radio was, I suppose, the right level, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was playing John Betjeman, who he adored.
They look quite similar, actually. I can see that.
Yeah, they're not dissimilar. Yeah. And so it was cruel that, I mean, in a way, it's, you know, rather nice to be cut off in the middle of your work, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But,
that was very special, actually, on Christmas Day that year. It was aired, that show. And so we were having a Christmas in a hotel, actually, that year. And we all gathered again, you know, to listen to it live. Aww. On the radio, which was really special.
That's so nice. But, yeah, that's sort of like really, he was there really at Christmas. Special. Like, that's like,
yeah.
Wow.
It was extraordinary.
Yeah, to hear his voice. Was that very strange as well, after months of not hearing it?
Very strange.
Yeah.
And he was... it's, you know, from this medium, what an intimate... I mean, I adore radio and I adore audio mediums, and I just think it's such an intimate way to communicate. And that felt, you know, the absolute height of it. More so, I think, than if we'd seen him on screen.
Yeah,
even,
yeah.
It's his voice right there. And he was... There were real mannerisms, his own mannerisms in his performance that were just beautiful, that were so recognisable. Little laughs or little moments. Yeah, it was a special time, actually, to listen to that.
God, that is a really strange loop of, you know, that it happened on Christmas Day as well. That, you know, like, of all the days where radio played.
That's when it was aired, yeah.
Yeah, to sit there and listen to him on that year. God, that must have been extraordinary. What a strange experience. So you just graduated.
Yeah, and I was filming at the time.
Oh, okay.
And I think I was due in the next day. It was my first week on a job.
Wow.
Called The Kid Who Would Be King. And, you know, I'd been preparing for it for a long time. And then this was the first week. I think had I had my first day? I don't think I had, you know. Maybe I'd had just my first day. Mm. And then... this happened, and you know, I just called up and said, "I'm sorry, I won't be in today or tomorrow." I think, but I did go back in that week, which was, you know, I think I didn't know what else to do, you know. But you're carrying a strange something into work with you, you know. It's like but it was nice to be with people, to be at work, to carry on with that journey, I think. At the time,
it's funny. I was just thinking, like, I've spoken to a lot of performers who've been like, "Oh, then I went and did a gig. I went and did a thing," and really? I think, but I'm also thinking when I speak to normal people, they'll often say things like, "Oh, I went back to my job." You know, like, I think it's quite common, because, like you said, I think, like, it almost goes back to what we're talking about, of, like, because we don't have a lot of, like, rituals or ceremonies. Sometimes it's like, what else are you gonna do? Just sit there and stare at the telly. Mm-hmm. Like, so you kind of just do things. I mean, I went and did, like, my GCSEs, like, 2 weeks after my dad died. And I remember people sort of being like, "Well, do you want to?" And I was like, "Well, what else am I gonna do? Like, all my friends are doing that thing. I should be doing that thing." It'd almost be an effort not to go and do that thing. Like, that would take thought. And I think that's the thing, especially if you've got a job booked, you're like, "Well, I'd have to think about what I would do instead."
Yeah.
And then I will be thinking about them and that they've died. So, yeah, it gives you that sort of place to direct stuff. And I know a lot of people I've spoken to this year, that's been one of the hard things. They haven't had the distraction of work, you know, they've been at home. And, you know, maybe they've been working from home, but obviously it's not the same as, like, you get on the tube or you get picked up for a job and you go into hair and makeup and all these people talk to you. And it's just kind of like, like you said, you're kind of carried through the day slightly. But, I think sometimes we worry, like, "Oh, should I have done that? Gosh, what is the other option?" Like,
well, I don't know what the right answer is, really. Yeah. I think it is a shame that we lack those rituals, those things that you feel like your ancestors might have done to remember their dead. You know, like, it's weird, that drive, what you said, what else will I do?
Yeah.
That drive to do something was so strong in my experience. And I've written a little play called Homeward Bound, which is going to be audio as well. And my drive to write that was to try and explore the fact that you're constantly doing something in the absence of anything else. So I remember when we got back home after he died, you know, immediately we were ringing up to sort of register the death or speak to someone about, you know, writing an obituary for him or, you know, perhaps we should go to his house and start clearing through the things. You know, immediately it was this drive to do, because I think we didn't have anything else to cling on to. We didn't have any ceremony or to perform, you know. Yeah, it was just this sort of need in us to try and accomplish the admin or accomplish the tasks that were waiting. You know, it was way too soon to start doing that.
I think that's so common that people like get straight in it, like for like 2 weeks, and then it sort of hits them about it, and then and everything slows down because they're like, "What am I doing?" But that is such a common thing, and I wonder, like, does it come from like you couldn't save them? So like, there's this energy of like, I wanted that not to happen. So what can I do? Oh, I can ring someone. I could do like, I don't know. But it feels like it's like this energy of like, even though like you said, somebody is, you're fully aware, like that's what's got to happen. That's okay. Again, that rational side of your brain is like, yes, they are dying. That's it. There's nothing I could have done. But there's another part of you that's like, no, something that shouldn't have happened. That's not okay. Yeah. What can I fix? Right, I tell you what I can do. I can ring the funeral. And I think not everyone reacts like that. Obviously, some people just, you know, collapse into a heap, or some people stop speaking. Mm-hmm. There's all different ways to react. And, you know, neither is wrong. But, yeah, I think it comes from this urge to kind of somehow make it okay. Make it okay that they're gone.
I think that's a really generous way of looking at it. that's amazing. I'd never thought of it like that.
I mean, I could be really wrong. I'll wait for my email from the psychotherapist being like, Carriad, that's not how people work. I sometimes get, Carriad, what you said on episode? I'm like, oh, yeah. I'm not qualified.
Just having a chat.
Give me out random advice.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carriad Lloyd. When did you start writing the play then? Was that this year?
No, it was, I think it, well, it came from a couple of things. I think I started writing it a couple of years ago, but it's just been on and off, you know, for quite a long time, and has only started to really crystallise, you know, in my mind recently. It came from, first of all, that drive to do, and not have anything else to cling to, no rituals. And it also came from the scattering of my dad's ashes, which truncated, strange thing where that Christmas, when we'd been at the hotel and we'd listened to him on the radio, we'd brought in a yogurt pot a little portion of his ashes to go and scatter on Queen's Lane near some of the theatres in the West End that he'd performed at. And it was late at night by the time we did this. And, you know, you can imagine, like, it was one of those bucket pots, right?
Yes.
It was so surreal and strange. And, you know, out we all went, and we sort of tossed his ashes. And in my head, I thought that it would just kind of disappear somehow.
Yeah, beautifully.
You know, the ashes. It would just go. But of course, there were these, you know, masses of tourists every year. It was Christmas Day, and we were just sort of shoveling this ashes all across the street outside the theatre where, on Shaftesbury Avenue, you know, where Les Mis is on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And people were sort of, you know, treading all over it. And it was just this really peculiar situation. It wasn't romantic in any way. And, you know, my sister was getting very upset about the fact that people were just suddenly treading all over him. You know, it really wasn't how we'd envisaged it. And it was so, yeah, just not, yeah, it was just so peculiar and funny. It was really funny. And then the next time, you know, we saved the rest of his ashes, so we'd sort of divided them, you know, for another time, and that happened quite a while later. And that was changed because of the presence of his grandchildren, who can't take in what's going on.
Yeah,
we did it
yeah.
in near a cricket ground that he used to go and watch. But they're too young to be able to understand the sort of the solemnity, if you're trying to find something of that, of the moment. And so equally that became sort of like a stamping match, you know, and like those two experiences prompted me to think, you know, I think the scattering of the ashes, if we do have any ceremony, is one of the things that remains.
Yeah.
But even in that, there's no formality, there's no set way of doing things. So we really, really stumble our way through it, and it's nothing like we think it's going to be. And there's problems of when you do it, where you do it. Can anyone remember what he wanted?
Yeah.
Is it for him or them, you know? And yeah, the play is essentially about that, is about exploring those scattered memories that a family is left with in the aftermath, and trying to fulfill both what they want and what the person who's died wants.
Yeah, it's so tricky,
you know, mixing the ages, people who feel differently and reacting differently to the grief. It's an exploration of that, really, but certainly is infused with the comedy that happens in those moments.
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think if someone's given me a graceful scattering of ashes story. I can't think of what ours was. Yeah, equally very comical. And I think...
Was it?
Oh, I think I've said this on the show before. So we scattered his ashes in Wales. He was Welsh. Yeah. And we went back to this sort of place near where he grew up. And... oh, God. So it's me, my mum, my brother. I think he was in an ice cream tub, you know. And then I think the trouble is with ashes is everyone's quite uptight, not uptight, but you're like, oh, we're going to do it, we're going to do this thing. So you're a bit worried, like, how am I going to be? Like, is this upsetting? But you haven't thought of the actual action of tipping something. You haven't thought about that. You just thought, we're going to, because the word scattered is lovely. Oh, I'm going to scatter his ashes.
Lovely.
You're imagining sort of a vicar just throwing them elegantly into like the sea, and it sounds beautiful. You have to tip a lot of somebody, and it's a lot. And yeah, it was really windy in Wales, obviously, and pissing it down. And my mum sort of scattered it, and a bit flew back and went in my eye, a la Big Lebowski. And I was like, they were kind of solemn. And I was like, guys, it's like really in my eye. Like, it's like really, really in my eye. And then my mum and brother were like, look at me like, is she upset about it? And I started laughing. I was like, no, this is beyond... And you know, you've really got something. That's quite painful, actually. Like, and then eventually I got it out and I was like, oh, God. Like, everything about it was just so real, you know? Like, so real. Like, glamour, no kind of, you know, writerly filmness, televisionness, that kind of no cut to them walking away beautifully, just like no there's no cut to, we're still here, this is still happening. And I think I don't know anyone who's told me sort of a really graceful story. And often people want to get scattered in the sea, and that's actually quite difficult because they don't all go in the sea straight away. They kind of fly around a bit, and it's It's hard. And even though I think cremation is lovely, when I've, you know, if you go to a burial, you're like, it's like simple about that, isn't it? They're just all in, it's done. Like, that is the ritual. And there isn't sort of a ritual for scattering ashes, I guess. I don't think so.
Do you know, I think you're right. And I think part of the thing I often think is the lack of physicality in, like, our secular culture is really a shame, because, you know, my girlfriend's side of the family are quite religious, and when they have had funerals, there's always a tradition of singing at the graveside and the family dig the grave.
Right, yeah.
And it's such a... I don't want to appropriate or, you know, kind of explore something I'm not necessarily entirely connected to, but, like, there's something about the fact that you're physically doing something that feels connected. I mean, you know, if you're exploring that relationship between the body and the spirit, which I think, you know, even if you are totally a devout atheist, something about death makes you desire to explore that relationship, you know. And there's something just about doing something physical, which I think, I don't know, it connects you somehow.
But it's almost the comfort to what we're saying of, like, that energy of needing to do something. Like, if you dig a grave, that's that energy. It's like, I did something. I've done something. I did this for you. Yeah. And that's connected to your death. Whereas I think what we have to deal with now, like you said, is, like, phone calls to a registrar or, like, ringing up a bank. And it all seems so disconnected from them and their dead body. You're like, what's this got to do with, you know, the fact that I've just watched a person stop breathing? Like, oh, is that HSBC? Yeah, okay, so there's quite a few accounts. Gosh. And it's like, it does seem so... You said it's not... Yeah, that I really understand what you mean, that physicality of, like, digging something or doing something connected to their death feels helpful, useful. I think that's something is you don't feel very useful, do you? You feel really useless. And so anything that makes you feel useful. And the singing, but I'm such a... I've said it before on the show. People should plan now. If you have good singers, they need to come to the funeral. You need to tell them now. Because there is nothing worse than... And again, I'm using this very, like, flippantly, but, like, English people who haven't been to church for 20 years trying to sing hymns they don't know. Like, that makes a funeral sad. Like, you want, like... You know, Welsh people are really good getting involved, singing straight away. Like, you want, you need people who are going to, like, be comfortable with...
Belt.
Yeah, belt, and be comfortable with celebrating something that is sad. And I think, like you said, we're so far removed from it now that, like, often when people go to a church service or crematorium, like, that's the first time they've been in that kind of institution, maybe all their life, or, like, in 10, 15, 20 years' time. So everyone feels very like, oh, I don't know how to behave in this. And that's what rituals give you. They give you this code of, like... You just have to do this. Yeah. And it's funny. Yeah, my husband is a devout atheist. And we went to a wedding. And I was brought up like Church of England, you know, not particularly religious. And we went to a Catholic wedding. But there was bits in it that I recognised. I was like, oh, yeah. And I was standing up at the right. And I've never seen him so... He was so confused. And he was like, how do you all know? Why is everyone standing up at the same time? What did you... Really? And I was like, oh, you... Obviously, it's fine, you're raised atheist, but I was like, oh, I see, there's all this, like a hidden language that he had no idea what was going on at all. Absolutely no idea. I mean, you know, when equally, if we went to, like, a Communist Party manifesto meeting, he'd be way more up on board than I would be, because his parents were, like, very, very, very hardcore left wing. so you learn different rituals, is what I mean. But, yeah, I do think they're such good handholds, aren't they, for what is a very confusing situation. So if you can have that, I think it does help. And again, I'm the same as you. Like, I haven't been in that situation where that was what was given to me. And I've spoken to people who are religious who've said, well, it was quite constraining, or I felt like if I didn't hit those rituals, if I didn't do them, then I was doing it wrong.
I see.
So you're like being given this code, or people who were like, it was too much. Suddenly everyone's around the house and you don't want them around the house. You want some peace.
Okay.
So it's hard, you know, there's no right, but I think you're right in that kind of vaguely secular way is missing some kind of structure to it.
I mean, having this conversation is really making me reflect on whether it's just my desire to have that actually there is no good way of going about it, and that I've thought for so long, oh, if only I'd had that, then I would have really known how to grieve. Yeah. Then I would have, you know, da, da, da. But like, actually, whatever happens, it's hard, which I'm sure is true as well.
Yeah, and it wasn't until I think I spoke to someone at a Griefcast Live, and she was saying that her religion had a set amount of days to grieve. Right. And after that, you expected to not grieve. And I was like, oh, that's hard. And she was like, yeah. So she was like, my family are expecting me at the moment to kind of not talk about it. It's done. We've done all the rituals. We've done all the ceremonies. It's done. And and that was the first time I was like, oh, yeah, that's hard, isn't it? Because I had been similar to you of like, but it would be nice if we'd had this thing. And you're right. You come back to, it's just hard. It's just a hard thing. And sometimes these things are great. And sometimes they're, I mean, that's why we have tea. Like you said, that's why this thing of make a cup of tea exists, because we don't have anything else, but we all know how to do that. And you can say to someone, put the kettle on, and you're like, yes, we can all do that. That's something we can all do, because we don't, you know, we can't start doing anything religious particularly.
Cara, did you ever speak to your dad about what he did for his dad, or you know, how he dealt with grief?
Well, no, funny enough. Yeah, it's funny. Obviously, it's funny because I'm a comedian. To me, it's funny. It's quite sad. My dad died before his mum and his dad.
Oh my gosh! So sorry.
Yeah, you know, that's okay. And so my grandfather died 6 months after him, pretty much of a broken heart. And my dad was actually quite shit with grief. My mum's parents died a few years before he did. In very quick succession. It was very, you know, they were old, but it was still obviously very hard. And my mum said, like, he was really rubbish. He was like, oh, come on, you know, 6 months, let's get on with it. And my mum was like, my parents just died. And he was a bit, and I think it's so funny that I am now so obsessed with grief, and I do this show and I read books about grief and I'm writing about grief. And I keep thinking, yeah, he was probably one of the worst people about it, because he just hadn't really, I don't think he'd had any like massive losses. So he was very like a kind of full of energy, like just drive through it, get through it, keep going, be positive, you'll be fine. Like that was his vibe. So when my mum was grieving, he just found it really difficult, because he was like, well, they're dead. What do you do? Come on, move on. Let's keep going. Which obviously is like the worst way to deal with it. I remember saying that to my mum. I was like, oh, was dad good after, you know, granny and granddad died? She was like, no, it's absolutely awful. I don't know. I think he would have been quite rubbish. But is that something you didn't get to talk to your dad about?
Well, part of the play at the end, when they're scattering the ashes, there's a character, Laura, who's his daughter. And instead of making a speech about him, she asks the questions she would have liked answered of him. And one of those is, did you speak at your father's funeral?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't know whether the character maybe feels guilt that she didn't, or, and I think that it relates to not only the desire to do something that you know is practical or ceremonial after someone died, but I had this strange sense of wanting to know what he'd done and how people before me have grieved, you know, and so that you are continuing some kind of there is some kind of consistency or legacy, I don't know what how to put it, but that you feel as if in honouring their death you're honouring how they dealt with death, and that continues back and back and back and back.
Did you speak at his funeral?
I didn't speak at his funeral, but we had a memorial service, which was much later. And I spent a long time, you know, on my speech for that. So, yeah, I did. For his memorial. So I'm glad that I did.
Yeah, and so I guess you... Yeah, did he ever speak about death to you? Or his parents' death? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, catastrophize.
He spoke about death, you know, he was so, so close with his dad.
Right.
You know, incredibly close. And he did speak. He was a peculiar mixture, my dad, because he loved England and was very English in so many ways. But he had none of the sort of stiff upper lip, you know, that we associate with Brits. He was so emotionally, like, turbulent, you know. He could be anything. He was loving and he was raging. He was, you know, really, really, and it could turn in an instant. And I'm really glad of that, because it means that when people talk about, you know, having that, you know, often with fathers, isn't it, that emotional disconnect, or particularly we didn't speak about certain things that might have been difficult, like death. I had none of that experience. We were very emotionally intimate, and he would speak about his own death, you know, fine. He wouldn't mind talking about that. And I think that's part of the reason that I feel now, 4 years on, only my own sadness rather than his sadness, because he was so open about the fact that he didn't want to go on and on and on, and he didn't want, you know, he didn't like being old, you know. There's a line in the play which is, getting old is ghastly, which my dad always used to say. So yeah, I'm really grateful to reflect on that, that there's, I don't feel like there were many stones left unturned in terms of those kind of conversations. I'd still love to hear more stories about him as a young man, and him, more stories about him, but that is something I'm grateful for.
Yeah, that's amazing that he was that open with you. I think that's really helpful. Like you said, I think that's helpful, because when someone dies, of course it's sad and awful, and the beginning is awful. But if you can, as you said, 4 years on, think, okay, I knew he wouldn't want, you know, I knew he was was aware of it, had processed it. It wasn't like, oh, it's the most terrifying thing that could ever happen to me, you know. Like, I think that's having those conversations is so important. And
definitely,
it's so weird, isn't it? Like, I mean, I say this a lot, like, just those questions, you know, those questions that you have, like, just ask them, just ask them. Because you never know when you need the answer. And sometimes it's hard. I really get that. Like, I, you know, it's not always easy to start a conversation, especially with a parent, of like, so when you die, what do you want? Yeah. But I just know from my dad sort of refused to talk about it. And when he was dying, and he just couldn't accept it, which now I'm much more sympathetic. I can understand, like, you know, he was 44 and he had cancer, he had two kids. Like, of course you're not feeling like this is fine. But at the time we were like, you know, again, the scattering of his ashes was a real, like, is this what he wanted? Like, we just didn't know. He'd said a few things that were just, like, definitely said to shut us up. Like, oh, just do that with it. We were like, you don't mean that. So again, you're like, well, he did say that, but we don't believe him. So it's sort of this, difficult. And to have those conversations, and it's funny, I mean, you're describing, like, that emotion, like you said, not being stiff upper lip, is my dad was similar. Like, I always thought he was kind of weirdly American in his viewpoint. It's very emotional, you know, which I guess you would describe as, you know, very American, kind of self-helpy, but would talk about lots of things. So I think, even though I don't have all the answers, I definitely have some of the answers, and that's helpful. But yeah, to have these conversations beforehand, it might be awkward now, I guess. It's a morbid thing to think, which I'm sure your father would appreciate. Like, it might be awkward now, but if someone dies, like you said, in 4 years' time, that's quite helpful. That's quite a, you know, once everything's settled, the dust settled, and you can kind of come back to those conversations and think, well, we did talk about death, and I did know they didn't like being old, and I did know that they were aware. Like, you sort of look for things later on, don't you?
Definitely. What about tributes to the person who's gone? Because I felt so sad, and you've touched on this, about how I would have loved to have shared what I'd written as a speech for him, for his memorial.
Yeah.
And so the my tribute to him, if you like, and all the things that, you know, I would have loved to have shared what I wrote, you know.
It's so hard, isn't it? Because I guess, like we said earlier, like, you don't share those things until someone dies, like, the really... Because also, but how can you? It would be bit strange. So, like, your dad probably would have been
that's the thing.
All right.
Like, it would be weird.
Yeah.
But, so I suppose there's nothing to regret there.
Well, I don't know if it's nothing. I think it's important, like, to acknowledge that feeling that you just... There's all those things you... Like, how important someone is. That's really what it is, isn't it? That you want to know and trust they knew how important they were and how much you appreciated them. Like, and then sometimes, like, you obviously got to say that in the speech. This person was everything. They were amazing. I love them.
Yeah.
And like you said, you worked on it and you had time to sort of eloquently put that. And it's hard that they didn't get to hear the really good version. Like, you're like, hang on, I've had time and I've thought about it. Here it is, you know. Whereas often what we say to each other is like, oh, you know, I love you. Okay, anyway, bye. Like,
I know, it's funny. It's that journey from being generalised, you know. Like, in the immediate aftermath, it's very generalised, the way that people talk about people. Mm. You know, it's like, oh, what a great da-da-da. And it's actually none of it's very close to the truth. It's only the time later that you can get specific about what that person was like. You know, their strengths, their flaws, that's odd, isn't it? You can't have that insight, I don't think, really, when you're with them or in the immediate aftermath, but it takes time to really understand who that person was, you know. And
it does, it takes time. And I think especially in that parental relationship, and I think someone said this the other day, maybe it was Jeff Norcott, this week's episode actually, he was saying, like, until someone dies, you're still in relationship to them. Right. So you can't kind of go, okay, job finished, this is what I feel. Because still ongoing, and there's all this stuff still happening. And after they've died, you can look back and go, oh, wow, what was that? What happened? Who were you? What did it mean? And like you said, and sometimes you come to the conclusion that, oh, that wasn't great. Or sometimes you're like, wow, you were amazing. And it's hard to say that when you're still in relationship to them, as in they're still alive. Because of course you're still in relationship to them while they're dead. That's just slightly different. I think it's sad. It is sad that you didn't get to say that, you know. I think that's okay. It's okay. That's not, you know what I mean? Rather than it's not something, because it's just a thing. It's just grief. It's just like,
it's just a thing.
It's just a fact. And I think sometimes we try and make the facts make sense. They don't. Mm. It's like people die and bodies stop working. And so we try and like make sense of that. And it's like, it doesn't really make sense. It's just odd, isn't it? That's what happens. It's hard to say things to people, like you said, in a big list. But I suppose, what is it that still pains you? Like, do you feel like he didn't know, or do you feel like you had the chance to really...
Yeah, I think just the chance.
Yeah.
I think so. It's funny, we were really different. We had like, because I was an only child, you know, from him and my mum, and my mum and him never lived together really, we had a very one-on-one relationship, if you see what I mean, that really grew into like a proper friendship. So yeah, I always felt like... It's funny, as you touched on it before, about I had the relationship of father-son, but then there are other people who had certain other things. But I felt like I had a really unique... That was a unique one about father-son, because it was just us most of the time when we were together. And yeah, we just really enjoyed each other's company. I mean, we had blazing rows. Most of the time, we'd see each other. He was... he lived quite a frugal life, my dad, you know. Like, he really didn't change anything in his house, and, you know, ate like the most ridiculous... It was always ready meals. He just couldn't cook at all. And by contrast, I suppose, I lived far more opulent lifestyle in comparison.
Yeah.
And yet, I was, you know, and diehard socialist, and my dad was conservative small c, so we used to like just have these enormous political rows, which I think we both quite enjoyed. And you know, you take the piss out of me going off and wearing my Marxist coat, you know. You'd say but like, it was out of that, I think that showed what I guess it was like a friendship, it really was. So I don't know whether that has any particular influence on why I wanted to be able to share my tribute, you know.
I think it's just hard, it's just sad when you clearly loved him and he clearly loved you. Like, you get that sense when talking to you, like, it was a good relationship and it was full of love, and you can tell when people talk about it that it was happy. And like you said, happy doesn't... I don't mean like, oh, we were always loving and we skipped along. It's like, that's not what happy means. Like, and I think with parents as well, like, that relationship's so complicated that if you can walk away from it being like, yeah, we were friends or we got each other, and that was like, that's really, really precious. And
yeah,
it's okay to miss that. To just be like, was great, I miss it, that was a really wonderful thing. And to have that sadness, and that's what it's taken me years and years to just go, all those things can exist at the same time. Like, I can be okay that they're dead, I can miss them, I can wish they were still here, I can be pissed off that they didn't get to see that, and I can be sad. Like, and actually, that's all, those things can just sit there and it's okay. They don't have, not one of them is not more important, one of them doesn't define it, one doesn't go, this is the thing, this is what it meant. Like, it will change, it just is the grief, and it just keeps sort of moving around. But that's taken me a long time. So you know, 4 years in, I think if you can even consider like, oh, we were, you know, I just miss him, that was sad, like, that's really impressive. And just want him to hear that tribute, I think that's, you know, that's fair enough. But I think he'd be extraordinarily proud of you, the fact that you, the fact that you had stuff to say, you know what I mean? There's some relationships where you're like, do you want to do a tribute? And the son would be like, nah, you're right. Like, you had a list, you had more than one thing, you know. I think that's really like a tribute. That's a tribute to you and him both putting in that time and making that relationship work, because that isn't, you know, it isn't a one-way street. It, both people have to be willing to do that and want to do that. So yeah, you know, yeah, I think that's really special. Well, Angus, thank you so much for talking to me. It was really, really lovely.
It's been so nice, Karen.
I hope it was okay. Sorry.
Yeah, no, really.
I always feel bad. People are like, it's like, do you want to come on my show and then cry? Like, and like dig up things that maybe you didn't want to think about today. So yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. And he sounds like such a lovely dad. Sounds like he was a good one.
He was a good bloke. Yeah, he's all right.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me about your dad, Benjamin.
It was so nice to be here. Thanks for having me, Cariad.
Angus's play, Homeward Bound, is available to download from the 4th of June for £5 from the Creation Theatre website. That's www.creationtheatre.co.uk. That's CREATION theatre.co.uk. As I said, it's a beautiful play that Angus stars in, as well as some other Archers actors, and about a sort of heartwarming and light-hearted drama about a brother and sister trying to scatter their father's ashes. And they will send you a downloadable link with a, I think, a password to listen to it on a phone or other device, as well as illustrations by Lucy Jollo as well that you can look at as you're listening to the play, and that is available to download from the 4th of June. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely. I think Angus was in Wales, I was in my living room. The show is edited by Kate Holland, music provided by the Glue Ensemble, and remember, you are not alone.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row, dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.